You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with artist Joseph Necpetal. He's living and working in Paris. Joseph, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for inviting me. Pleasure to join you.
Let's talk about what's happening now. I know you have a show in Berlin and in Paris. I'd like to ask about what's happening in your studio, but I imagine you're also preparing and working on those shows. So maybe just an overview of either what you're doing in your studio or what's happening in the two shows that are happening now.
Happily. I'll give a little overview. At the moment, just opened a couple weeks ago, I'm showing in Berlin at a place called Art Laboratory Berlin, which is a very interesting place, kind of focusing in on relationship between science, technology, and art. I like very much their program and have a couple of big canvases and a video projection from the most recent body of work that I've been showing. I'll get into what I'm doing now that I haven't shown yet, but it's sort of the third foot of a three-part show that I first started in New York at Gallery Richard. That was in 2012. Gallery Richard's in Chelsea. And then he has another gallery here in Paris. And I started showing another group from that series. That was in June, just last June in 14. So it's been kind of like a closure of this work. It's work that's been really focused on details of the human body. And the new work is kind of pulling back and getting a little more full figurative and returning to some literary roots, specifically Homer's Odyssey, which I've sort of taken as a theme for the work I'm working on now.
Sorry to interrupt. I want to talk about the other show too. But yeah, let's talk about how you approach the work, because I know this is an evolution from work that you've done involving technology and computers. Can you talk about your entry into that? Because your images look very painterly to me. So can you talk a little bit about how you approach the medium, how you got involved in that, and now I know this work is an extension of that, and I want to talk a little bit more about that, but just the beginnings of this, of the approach that you have.
Okay, I'll try to keep it short. The work started really from the work in the 80s that was real palimpsest sort of based drawings, where I was overlaying ideological imagery from the mass media to the point where sort of the representational content would break down. And these were generally all gray pieces, and I would blow them up first with the photomechanical technology, and then in 86 I was introduced to the first digital technology so we could scan the pieces. This is before the internet, of course, but we could scan the pieces and they could be painted with acrylic on canvas. So that was sort of the end point, was this technological possibility, which I thought dovetailed well with the idea of the computer as sort of the dominant ideology. I could more or less feel that coming even in the late 80s. And so that sort of took me down the road. And then my first period in France, I was invited to work as an artist in residence in a place called Arbois, which is just this little town near Burgundy in the Jura region. And it was specialized in computer technology. It has a place there called Arcassenon, which is, architects will know that from the Claude Nicolas Ledoux monument that's there in the museum. And I was an artist in residence there for 2 years, and I developed the programming side of the project, which got into the computer virus as an active participant in the work. So I could kind of launch these attacks onto this compressed imagery, again, building off of the the work from the 80s, the palimpsest work, let's call it. And it could, that would become the host, and then this viral agent, computer virus, would come in and, you know, destroy or transform or refigure what I had there, sort of the body of work that I was submitting to this attack. And that kind of became the first process along a long exploration of the programming side, which led me in 1999 to get involved with what's called artificial life, which is a technique of programming. Gets you into real time, then you can actually see what's happening in real time.
Is artificial life the same as artificial intelligence?
They're related, yes. They both try to duplicate, you know, natural phenomena. Artificial life is a little bit more of a biological function. It's not strictly cognitive, but they're related. What you want to do in artificial life is try to simulate biological functions, or evolutionary, or, you know, behavioral genetic functions, or other kinds of natural functions. So that led to sort of the second wave of this project, grandly called the Computer Virus Project. And that sort of led to this very last work. There was a pause. I wrote a book called Immersion into Noise a couple of years ago that kind of went back and looked at the relationship of this early work. I mean, it's not just about me, so I'm hardly in the book, but it has to do with looking at the principles that I was interested in, of kind of the disruptive aspect of something within the culture or within the artistic process, and kind of using that and exploring the metaphorical, you know, political power of that idea. This is kind of the last body of work was strictly focused in on little tiny details of the human body. The retina, the human retina is one, and the human anus was the other. I chose those two openings because they're the highest and the lowest on the human body, and they kind of represent the full spectrum of sensibility. But as I say, the new work is kind of, I kind of turned the page from that, and the new work is much more literary and poetic, again, based on Homer's Odyssey. They go on a voyage, you know, they take this trip through the viral process, and they get kind of mixed around, and they float, and it's really about getting lost, because I had the feeling that, particularly in Europe, I think America too, there's a sense of a kind of drift, you know, kind of a cultural, political drift. People are a little bit lost in terms of ideological rigor, and it kind of seemed to be a kind of parallel symbolic body of sensations, really, that I could kind of play with. So it's not strictly illustrative in any way. It plays with this kind of thematic material and just gives me license to explore figurative work again.
And so how is the figurative work actually put together? I mean, you're working on canvas. Is it computer assisted at all? How does that
Oh yeah. I haven't really changed my way of working, which is very it's very compatible to my lifestyle. I'm very happy with the result. I have been for a very long time, and it has a kind of a formal rigor to it, in that I start working on the computer. I might start with some digital photographs that I've taken. I might appropriate something from the internet, most likely. I might, you know, use drawing and other kind of photo-like painting techniques in the computer, and I can use any and all these things. Also, I can lace in little words. I can use language, you know, it's a very open area that I'm working in, and from that it all gets boiled down and goes through the computer virus process, which has to do with some, you know, this original programming that I discussed earlier, and that comes out with some interesting, possibly, imagery that is then captured and it's either captured as a stream and made into an animation, or, and most likely, it's also painted on canvas into these, you know, sometimes fairly large canvases. And I kind of insist on traditional artistic materials like canvas and wood stretcher bars and that way, because I do want to enter into this dialogue with the tradition of painting. As you, I was really happy to hear you say in the beginning that the images look painterly, because I'm not really interested in technology per se. I'm not interested in computer graphics per se or any of that. I am more or less a painter, drawer, a print person, and the sensuality of the piece is, you know, really what I'm after, how it delivers a kind of visceral artistic experience for the viewer. But the immersion into noise part is the challenge part that I'm kind of, I guess I'm kind of pushing back against the neo-pop culture and the, where everything's immediately available, immediately legible, and that's why I kind of encrypt the imagery into a rather dense fields. And so there's this kind of battle between the figure and the ground. The reason I do that is not just to, you know, infuriate or, you know, people, but I'm sort of setting up a possibility for them to decode what's happening there, but they actually need to use their own imagination to do that. You know, it's not given to them on a silver platter. Yeah.
And I mean, just to go back to that one question about that residency. So that residency was 2 years long, and you were invited to that residency. That sounds very unusual to me. How did that happen? That wasn't something you applied to? That was something...
No, it was an invitation. It was a very unique period. It was when Mitterrand was in power, the socialist president here, and he had decided to decentralize cultural activity outside of Paris. So he set up a program in all the little areas around France to invite artists, international artists, to come for these long-term residencies. I was invited by a curator to do that, and I went for it, and it seemed to be kind of a risky thing because I'd only lived in big cities before that, Chicago, New York. I'd never lived in a small villagey kind of area, but I was very attracted to it because it's a wine-growing area. It has a deep connection to Roman culture, and there's lots of, you know, interesting areas to explore at the same time. So I went with it, but that's how it happened. It was a kind of a one-off because after he went out of power and, you know, Chirac and the right came back, all those programs were more or less rolled back, to the best of my understanding.
Wow, I mean, that sounds extraordinary. And that was something that
91, 92.
Right, 91. And that was something that they were paying for? That was all expenses paid, or were you paying your way there as well?
No, they kind of covered my costs. I mean, I did, you know, feed myself, but they gave me free lodging, very nice free lodging, I might add, and access to this computer studio, access to a computer scientist named Monsieur Massenet, who helped with who did the writing. We worked on it together, but he wrote the first code to do the project. And then they did a big exhibition that traveled to Vienna and L.A. and New York after that. So, yeah, it was quite an exciting period for me.
That is. Now, I know that when you came back to New York, and I met you there once, you were teaching at SVA for a while?
SVA, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think I taught at SVA from 98, just after I got my doctorate, till I moved here, so 2 years ago.
And your doctorate was in what?
It was in the philosophy of technology, or the aesthetics of technology. Specifically, I was interested in virtual reality and sort of what the aesthetic goals of virtual reality are in terms of immersion. So it gave me an opportunity to kind of revisit the history of art and architecture and myth and, you know, philosophy. And that's really what's made up the body of the book, Immersion into Noise, that, as I previously mentioned, came out a couple years ago from the University of Michigan, published by Open Humanities. So, yeah, and maybe we could get into the music part of what I'm doing also, if you'd like.
Yeah, let's talk about music, and I maybe as a way of moving into the music, why the move to Paris,
Absolutely. So that led, after the first experience in Arbois, the Jura, that came to an end, I moved back to New York, moved back into my little apartment on the Lower East Side, but then I decided I really did enjoy the experience, so I applied for a one-year residency at Cité Internationale des Arts, which is a place in Paris. Got it. Moved there for the year. Ended up getting invited to do the doctorate in England, provided that I stay somewhere in Europe. There was funding provided for me by the European community with the proviso that I live in Europe. So I stayed in Paris mostly and through the help of a friend. And when that came to an towards the end, I ended up meeting a woman. You know, it becomes a love story. We ended up getting married.
That all happened in Paris?
This all happened in Paris, and then we sort of shared our life back and forth, 6 months in New York, 6 months in Paris, up till a couple of years ago when I got thrown out of the building I was living on in New York, and it meant everything came here.
Wow, that's a pretty romantic story.
I guess so, when you think about it. It's just daily life. Stuff happens, but...
Yeah, but still going to Paris, falling in love with a woman, you know, moving there eventually. Kind of dreamy. And is she a Parisian or an American?
She's a Parisian, originally from North Africa, but her family moved to Paris when she was a young girl. So yes, a Parisian. I also really liked, when I got to Paris, I decided I would, you know, that would be the end of the teaching because I couldn't go back to SVA because it didn't, you know, wasn't financially, possible. So I ended up writing a lot more here, and I've been doing regular reviews for Hyperallergic, which is this really great blog zine on the internet. And I became their Parisian correspondent, so I'm doing regular reviews of shows, sometimes book reviews. That kind of fulfilled my pedagogic, you know, interest or proclivity.
And that was also how you're earning a living at the time, or still are?
I wouldn't exaggerate. Let's not exaggerate. Earning a living. Yes, there's some income provided, but let's not call it a living. But yeah, but I really enjoy the process of thinking about art, looking at a lot of shows here. The thing about Paris, people may not know, is that there are a ton of little museums, and they're all trying to do really interesting shows to get the people. So I'm really, really amazed at the diversity of the shows that they put on. New York, you've got the three major museums, basically Chicago, two, and, you know, it's like that. But here you might have, I'm just pulling this number out of the hat, I guess there must be 25 to 30 museums, you know, from Rodin to, you know, you name it. And they're all putting on contemporary shows, or they're doing historically interesting shows. So I'm just really happy with the situation at the moment. I find Paris to be extremely stimulating artistically for my own work, but just as a art consumer, so to speak. I hate using that kind of language, but you know what I mean.
Sure, sure. Yeah, sounds wonderful. So let's talk about music now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, there's a couple things. Besides doing, I did a symphony using the same algorithms for the computer virus project, the artificial life part of it. That came out a few years ago, called the Viral Symphony. And I did a surround sound performance of it in 2012 in New York at the Harvest Works place. And, you know, I've done little presentations here and there. It turned out to be like a 5-movement, hour and 20-minute piece. And then I really got interested in the history of noise and music. So that was part of the other thing that led to the writing of this book, Immersion into Noise, to see how noise has been a creative element within, you know, classical music, but all kinds of music, avant-garde music most notably. And that led me to being invited to edit a book on a really wonderful noise artist named Minoy. He's dead. He was a Californian artist. I came across him in the 80s when I was editing and publishing a cassette magazine called Telus, audio cassette magazine.
That was also Harvest Works, wasn't it, Telus?
Yes, that came out of Harvest Works. Yes, that was our sponsor, absolutely. And anyway, this wonderful press called Punctum Books, I sort of pitched it at them and they went for it. It's a history of Minoy. It's a book that has a CD attached, you know, that comes along with it, if you want it. And I wrote his biography, but also I got more theoretical towards the end of the book and started to talk much, much more about sort of the need for disruption and noise within, you know, the art industry. And so I was able to exercise some of my more theoretical concepts on the book. And then in Berlin, a couple weeks ago, I did a little noise concert called Requiem for Diderot. And it was a section of this symphony that I overlapped, so you have a kind of an echoing, a delay echoing, almost like in dub music, you know? And
right.
It creates a kind of headspace that seemed to have a sort of a memorial-like aspect to it. So, yeah, I've been making music, performing music, writing about it. You know, it's one of my major interests. I would say besides the creative visual art interest, it's music and philosophy are sort of my two big things right now.
And how do you compose something like that? The first piece you were talking about, the Viral Symphony, having a background in classical music, was it approached that way?
No, not at all. It was approached more as a capture. What I did is instead of using an image as the host, I used a sound loop. I think it was a sound of a drop of water hitting a glass of water. So it's a tiny capture, you know, a two second file, sound file. That becomes the host, and the algorithm goes in and works its way in and around there, creating these incredible sounds, noises, sometimes very uninteresting, sometimes very interesting. So I captured a great deal of this work. Then I said, okay, now it's my turn. So that was sort of chance, you know, operation oriented. And I said, now I'm going to massage it and put it into something, you know, that I think is actually, you know, listenable and interesting and possibly emotionally, you know, impactful. So that's how it worked. It's like using chance operations and then going into the studio. And I worked on that with some collaborators. They're all part of the project. And you sort of massage it into different themes that had different emotional resonances and different instrumentations also. The last movement I added in through a synthesizer, real instruments like, you know, French horns and violins and pianos and stuff like that, along with the electronics. So you have a kind of electronic bass. It starts out all electronic, goes through, there's a spoken word part of it, and then it goes into a kind of quasi-classical sounding finale. It's a lot of fun.
It sounds great. And what's happening with that now? Are they performed? And if so, how?
I consider that a finished project. It's up on the internet. People interested could go to, I think it's called archive.org, or look on my website, and you can download it. And you know, it's an MP3 form, but which doesn't sound the same as surround sound, 5-point surround sound, which you can actually hear the sounds coming over the horizon, kind of passing through your head and going over the other horizon. You don't have that kind of experience, but, you know, you wear headphones and you have a pretty nice experience nonetheless. So that's you know, I've pretty much published it as an open piece on the internet. People can find it. It's called Viral Symphony.
Sounds fantastic. And it's exciting to hear how that continues to evolve. So, you know,
I'll send you a little MP3 file if you want. You can paste in a little snippet. I'll email
I'll put a link to that. Yeah, mm-hmm. I'll put a link to that in this interview. There will be a link to it in the interview.
Can I just add one thing before I forget?
Please do. Yeah.
I don't want to forget the newest media project that I'm working on. It's a collaboration with Reese Chatham and Black Safichi. Reese Chatham, you may know, is a minimalist composer with very much known for his electric guitar compositions, but he also plays beautiful flute and trumpet. For this piece, he provided the sound, and I wrote a very, very long erotic poem for my wife. It took years. And we decided to use that as the material, and the vocal artist, his name is Black Safichi, he recorded the whole opus. It's very, very lengthy. And we've put it together into a rather wonderful audio composition. And this, too, is scheduled to be published by Punctum Press. So the poem will come out as a small book, and the audio finished project, which is called Destroyer of Naivetes, will come out as a CD, you know, web MP3 filed.
That's exciting. There'll be information on that on the website as well. So you know, in closing, you're at this point in your career where you're really developed an approach and a way to bring all these things about. And some of these things, it sounds like the music especially, isn't in the marketplace. Is other work selling, or some of your work in the marketplace, or not?
I'm not really considered, you know, investable in anymore. I mean, I had my chance in the late '80s. Just as the crisis came, you know, the first crash, I was kind of swept aside and. For better or worse, that's sort of my market destiny. Yeah, I sell pieces here and there, one or two ever so often, but you don't see me, you know, in secondary auctions and things like that. You know, I am in some pretty good museum collections, but I think it's still an uphill trog, partly, I think, because of the digital materials that you know, I chose to work in, but it's also, I think, just the general conservatism of the art market, so to speak. I don't know if you agree with me on that, but that's how I perceive it. But
I hear that quite a bit. Yeah, I mean,
mm-hmm. None of this really bothers me. I mean, I'm able to survive. I live a modest but very nice life. I'm free to do my own work, you know, at my own pace, and I'm lucky to have a gallery that, you know, shows my work both in New York and Paris, and now this new gallery in Berlin. And I just had a show of early photography work in Arles in the south of France. So things come up. You know, I was just invited to Bangkok last winter to do a residency and do a thing on the book. So, you know, my life is just active enough and the work is just on the radar enough. But no, I would say I'm off sort of the mainstream market, for better or worse. That, you know, let's not be Pollyannish. That's how I see my situation.
Right. I mean, you said earlier something like you had your chance. Was there, did you make a decision? Was it around the 80s to not be part of the market, or do you think you could have taken another route? Is that what you meant
I did two things that an artist is not supposed to do. One is to change, and two is to, and this, that was my choice, but the other was outside of my control. You know, I was with this really good gallery, Brooke Alexander, at the time. They went through changes. That gallery broke up for their own personal reasons. And that was just at the time where my work was like going to auction. It had been collected by top collectors in the 80s. And I was somewhat, I didn't have the media hype of a Robert Longo, but I was somewhat in that, you know, area. Let's put it that way, if I can think I'm fair to say it like that. And it just, after that, the gallery sort of dissipated. I ended up, as I just described, living in Europe, in France in the early 90s. And I kind of let the commercial side slide. Then I got involved in writing my PhD. I had a few shows here and there, mostly in Paris, but in Italy also, in Torino. And as I say, like these hit and miss places here and there. And so I think I kind of like faded out of that blue chip possible, you know, running. And now I'm kind of just a free agent. You know, I can do whatever I want without worrying about, you know, how are my collectors going to react, you know. So it's a mixed blessing. On one hand, sure, I'd love to have selling more pieces, be in more shows, have more curators interested in my work, et cetera, et cetera. But I have total freedom at the same time. So, you know, I'm not going to cry any big crocodile tears about it at the moment.
That makes sense. And it sounds like a place that, you know, I interview so many different artists, and most of the ones that seem maybe not the happiest, but it's one avenue to take, the idea of producing the work that you want to produce and not having the market as what's always, you know, front center all the time, but to be able to explore also and have the freedom of not having the market pressure as
yeah,
attractive as it may be to have that income. It's also nice to be free from the pressure, as you're saying, not to change, because that's what you want to do constantly.
I think it does, the market does limit experimentation. It really does, with medium, with subject, with many other things. And okay, there are great rewards, as we know. But the downside is your freedom to experiment, to really go wherever the idea or the dream is leading you to go. I think you have to give that up to be like a real, you know, market wonder. And I don't know. I haven't compromised. I can tell you that. And so I can look at myself in the mirror.
Joseph, thanks so much for talking to us today. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Again, thanks for the invite. It was really fun talking to you, too.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.